From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, lessons learned in the 1980s that may apply as the Detroit Three confront overseas EV competition.
You know, they went through all the stages of grief. You know, first years there's denial, and then there's anger about these are not real cars. Why would anybody want this little tiny car? And then kind of bargaining.
Also, what life was like in Michigan's oldest city in 1776.
As amazing as it might sound, a young Frenchman named Etienne Brulé was here in 1621, like a year after Plymouth Rock.
And one writer's vision of Detroit's golden age and all of its secrets.
But Detroit, oh my goodness, was an uncombed historical wilderness.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A little later this hour, we're going to dive into an exciting new novel set amidst the glitz and grime of Prohibition-era Detroit.
It wasn't exactly the era of freedom that we've read about. There were young women who were trying to seize power amidst a society determined to deny it.
Author Ruta Sepetys speaks with us later this hour. But first, a recent New York Times article muses about the future of the domestic auto industry. Over the past few years, GM, Ford, and Stellantis have designed and built all these new electric vehicles to keep up with a global wave of competitors, particularly a fleet of inexpensive EVs made in China. Those plans went through whiplash as the Trump administration revoked consumer tax incentives for electrics and then imposed tariffs affecting the United States' closest partners in North American automotive production. The industry has responded by pivoting back to internal combustion engines that are still popular in the United States, but whose global market share is in decline. Susan Helper is a professor at Case Western's Weatherhead School of Management. She advised the White House for economic policies under both the Obama and Biden administrations. Her research focuses on the impacts of organization and supply chains, with a special focus on the Detroit Three in the 1980s, when the industry was facing considerable new competition from Japan. Sue Helper, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be here and talking to you.
Sue, you came to this space as a scholar who was looking at the domestic automotive industry during a time in the 80s when Japan was capturing a bigger and bigger section of the global consumer market and the American market with, wait for it, low-cost efficient vehicles. This is going to sound very familiar to folks who are maybe new to paying attention to automotive matters. Can I just ask you what your reaction was over the past couple of years as China started really picking up momentum in global sales with brands like BYD and Geely? Was this a moment of deja vu for you?
Oh, yeah. And I was like, oh, wow, this makes the Japanese challenge look easy. You know, the Japanese had slightly lower wages, but not, you know, wages a third to 10% of what the American wages are. And they had some Chinese, some government subsidies, but not 30% subsidies. So this is, like the Japanese challenge on steroids.
Yeah. Well, let's take it back to the 80s. What were some of the factors that Detroit was looking at in trying to consider its market viability? What decisions ended up being crucial in how the U.S. makers fell behind Japan? What did they decide to make and what did they decide not to make?
So I think a lot of it was the idea that we had cheap gas and so we should make large gas-guzzling vehicles, and that if consumers wanted a cheaper car, their best option was a used Buick, as the president of GM said. And so then what that did was left space for the Japanese to come in with cars that were not only cheaper and more fuel efficient, but also more reliable.
And cheaper to fix.
Yes, cheaper to fix, less likely to break in the first place. And a lot of it came from a really different approach to production that we've called lean production, focusing on the low inventory aspects of that production system. But that wasn't all of it. A lot of it was really long-term relationships with suppliers and workers that led to a real skill at the Japanese word now common in Michigan, Kaizen, or continuous improvement, and just an incredibly honed machine to get that done, perfected really by Honda and Toyota.
My memory for this period isn't good on global sales. Were Ford and GM and Chrysler as involved in overseas markets as they are today?
Oh, more so. They've retreated actually a lot from these overseas markets. Henry Ford actually, around 1920, set up his first plant in England. So Ford has had a long, long time overseas. And still about a third of Ford's car sales, I believe, are from overseas, and more than that for General Motors.
When you were researching this period of Detroit's really real moment of clarity, what did you learn about how the automakers decided that they needed to get serious about Honda and Toyota?
The way I've thought about it is, they went through all the stages of grief. First there's denial, and then there's anger about these are not real cars. Why would anybody want this little tiny car? And then kind of bargaining, and I think some very important joint ventures that Ford with Mazda and GM with Toyota, that did result in some learning, and then finally acceptance. Although I think there's still, I think, things that the Detroit Three have not fully learned from Toyota and Honda around long-term relationships with suppliers and workers.
I mean, so much of what you found during that period seems to apply to things that we're looking at today. Let's bring the conversation forward now to what's been happening over the past 5 years. Ford and GM and Stellantis all had electric ambitions and had rolled out a number of fleets and models, which not entirely, but many of which definitely seemed aimed at capturing a higher end of the market, perhaps already reading some writing on the wall about where China was headed in terms of the kind of models it wanted to make. What factors did you see contributing then to their separate decisions for a complete about face to go all in on internal combustion engines?
I criticize the Detroit Three a fair amount, but I also really think they play an incredibly important role as large unionized employers that offer middle class jobs and that innovate, continue to innovate in very difficult situations. And so I think there's two things that make the EV thing difficult for American automakers. One, of course, is these policy turnarounds. Every 4 years, there's a different policy. We actually invented the LFP batteries that China has been using to so much effect. And this is, of course, just one example of many of things that we invented that have been commercialized overseas. And then this company went bankrupt, A123 in Michigan, and was bought for fire sale prices by a Chinese company.
Sue, the losses in the auto industry have been really staggering with this back and forth on whether the industry will continue to pursue EVs or stick to its traditional favorites with internal combustion engines. $19 billion for Ford alone and $26 billion for Stellantis. I know that we're dealing with two different periods and industries that are in different places, but how do you see that comparing with the economic hardships of the period that you researched in the 80s?
So in some ways, this is more difficult because there are new investments that the companies are feeling like they need to mothball. In the 80s, it was existing assembly plants that needed to be closed, or that the companies felt that they had no choice but to close. So my guess is that the cost and the suddenness of this reversal is going to prove to be far more costly than the rise of the Japanese.
Do you see there being any precedent for an original equipment manufacturer like Ford or GM to come back from losses like that?
Oh, sure. I mean, I actually think, the companies came back from the losses in the 80s and 90s. Certainly, in terms of profits, they've had some of their most profitable years ever since that period. Employment has not come back, but I think that yeah, it's the story of the auto industry is not a foregone conclusion. There's a huge amount of knowledge in the auto industry, and particularly in Michigan, that can still be drawn on. And I am always an optimist, but I think even considering that, I think there's plenty of room for continued innovation and for continued catch up and even surpassing of the Chinese.
I guess my last question for you is, when you think about the process of digging out during the 80s, did the federal government have any role to play in helping the industry do that?
Yes. So a key was these voluntary export requirements that Reagan put in, actually, that limited how much Japan could export to the US. So then that essentially forced them to invest in the US. So I think that was very important. I think we could do better than that. So one issue with a quota is then you bring in your highest margin cars. This actually pushed Toyota to create the Lexus. So the really aiming even more directly at the strength of the American auto industry. And it also, there was no requirement for any kind of job quality in the jobs that were created here. So I think we could do better. But that was a really key role. There's also been ongoing support for innovation in the auto industry. I think the Detroit Three and the Department of Energy have long collaborated on fuel efficiency, on batteries. Actually, the lithium-ion battery was largely invented at Argonne National Lab. So I think there's an unheralded potential role even in the 80s, or an actual role even in the 80s for the government.
Sue Helper is a professor at Case Weatherhead School of Management in Cleveland. Sue, thank you so much for sharing your research with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be here and talking to you.
We're going to take a short break now. In a moment, what was happening in Michigan 250 years ago?
The rapids of the St. Mary's River had abundant whitefish in them, and it was a great source of protein for the natives.
That story's next. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Okay, quiz time. What is the oldest city in Michigan? It's not Detroit, founded in 1701. Need a hint? Maybe think farther north, like Upper Peninsula North. Founded in 1668, Sault Ste. Marie holds the title of oldest city in Michigan and also stands among the oldest cities in the United States. As we mark the United States' 250th anniversary this year, we got curious about what life was like in Sault Ste. Marie around the time of the nation's founding. Joining us now is a historian, author, and board member of the Chippewa County Historical Society, Bernie Arbic. Bernie, welcome to Stateside. Good to have you.
Thank you very much, April. I'm very happy to be here and will enjoy talking about the history of my hometown.
Hey, so can we start with some basics? Who were the early European settlers who got Sault Ste. Marie off the ground?
Well, certainly the French were by far the earliest, and as amazing as it might sound, a young Frenchman named Étienne Brûlé was here in 1621, like a year after Plymouth Rock. But some of the others who came, French Jesuit priests, were right in the forefront. Father Isaac Jogues, he's now a canonized saint. Saint Isaac Jogues was here in 1641. And later, Fathers Marquette and Dablon established a mission here in 1668, which we take to be the founding of the first white settlement in Michigan.
What can you tell us about the Native nations who would have been living here when those settlers started arriving?
Well, the Ojibwa, also called Chippewa, it's just two spellings of the same word, had long been here, largely because the rapids of the St. Mary's River had abundant whitefish in them. And even in the summer, sometimes natives came from rather far away to get some of that fish, and I gather smoked it too. Preserve it as they could. So sandstone, which an underlying ledge of sandstone made the rapids there. I call it the bedrock of Sioux history because it brought the Native Americans and the Native Americans brought the early French.
Can you describe maybe what the community that became Sault Ste. Marie, what it would have been like when it was founded?
Well, again, it was largely Ojibwe who were here, and the Jesuits wanted to gain converts. There were very few whites that were here. Voyageurs or coureurs de bois came through here, headed to Lake Superior for furs.
Trappers and traders, right?
Yes. The mission left in 1695, and there was a long quiet period, really up until just about 1750. You can hardly find any recorded names. So it was, of course, Native Americans were still here, but the French were only passing through, I think. But in 1750, a very monumental thing happened. The French and Indian War had not yet started, but it was certainly brewing, and a very large land grant was made by King Louis XV of France to a French military officer named Pierre Le Gardeur de Repentigny. This grant was like over 300 square miles along the St. Mary's River. It was typical of French land grants, Detroit the same way, narrow on the river, very deep lots to give a lot of people frontage on the river. But a condition of that grant was that he would construct a fort here in Sault Ste. Marie for the protection of French voyageurs and also to try to keep the local natives trading with the French rather than the British. So that fort was the first in the Sioux, and Repentigny, a French military officer, is someone who deserves more comment because he not only was engaged during the French and Indian War, I gathered down along in the Ohio River Valley. But he also, when the French lost that war, the treaty in 1763 called for the French to leave North America. And so they did. Repentigny then left too. He refused to become a British subject. And he went to an island in the Caribbean called Guadeloupe. And during the Revolutionary War, he actually led French troops from Guadeloupe in an action that is known as the Siege of Savannah, 1779. The British were controlling Savannah, and the French tried to break that control by laying siege, but that effort did not fail. However, Repentigny is recognized as having fought with the revolutionaries against the British in the Revolutionary War.
Bernie, reading about the period, it seems kind of hard to overstate what a huge factor the fur trade was in the life of the time. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about the economic drivers that would have guided people's lives in those days, beyond all these military engagements that were happening?
Yeah. Well, there were very large flotillas of canoes. Radisson, I mentioned earlier, brought one through the Sioux from Western Lake Superior in the 1650s. They were called Montreal canoes. They had crews of 12. They could carry 4 tons of freight, and they came through the Sioux. They headed by the traditional route down to Lake Huron into Georgian Bay, and then getting into the French River brought them up to Lake Nipissing near North Bay, Ontario, and then down into the Ottawa River headed for Montreal. So the natives, certainly that was their major trade item for them to present. As far as I know, you know, they were getting iron pots for making maple syrup and weapons and beads and so forth. But that was certainly the largest economic driver. And in fact, in 1794, another major figure arrived in the Sioux named John Johnston. He was an Irishman, came to North America seeking a fortune and married a native woman, set up a family and a fur business in Sault Ste. Marie in 1794. And one of our historic structures that still exists is the John Johnston home that goes back to the early 1800s.
A lot of Michiganders may be aware that there actually is a Sault Ste. Marie on the other side as well. Did these communities grow up together, do you know, or were they pretty much always separate entities?
They were one community. I mean, literally, it's a mile, roughly, from the border of the river in Sault, Michigan, to Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. They were largely one community. As a matter of fact, to make that point, in 1820, Territorial Governor Lewis Cass led an expedition here and on into Western Lake Superior. It was very confrontational, and there were fears that there was going to be some serious bloodshed. All of the women and children, Native women and children in Sault, Michigan, jumped into canoes and headed across the river to Sault, Ontario, where they had relatives and knew it very well. So, you know, this was in 1820. In fact, between the Revolutionary War and the Treaty of Paris and the Jay Treaty later, that basically said, this was in 1794, the south side of the St. Mary's River is American, but de facto, it was still British that controlled this area. And that's one of the reasons Lewis Cass came here. He was tasked with trying to get the natives to agree to a cession of land so that a U.S. fort could be built. And that's what happened in 1822. A fort named Fort Brady was built on the river, largely to show the American flag.
There are many parts of southern Ontario and the northern United States that have these elements of English and Native and French history, and ultimately American history, in their backgrounds. Are there ways that you explain to people, you know, the way that people lived side by side with each other and how the change started to happen as the United States grew and developed into the regional controlling power?
You know, the French presence here declined fairly rapidly, especially once Fort Brady was built. You will not hear French spoken on the streets of Sault, Michigan, very unlikely in Sault, Ontario, even. You're much more likely to hear Italian if you hear a European language, or Finnish, you know, migrations over the years. So once Fort Brady came, things started shifting towards the English quite a bit. We have so many French place names, however, not only in this area, but in Michigan as a whole. Indeed, Detroit, you know, means the Straits. And Sault Ste. Marie, by the way, try to pronounce it the way the French would have pronounced it, Sault de Sainte Marie, which the French word S-A-U-L-T, at least in Old French, meant falls or rapids. And so this was literally the falls of Saint Mary, or Saint Marie. The Jesuits named this area, their mission was the Mission de Sainte Marie.
Would you say that that shared history paved the way for the lives that people live in Sault Ste. Marie today?
Well, one thing I would like to mention about Sault Ste. Marie, a major development in my lifetime, was the federal recognition of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. You know, I believe the federal act that recognized the earliest tribes was in the 1930s. There was a tribe about 15 miles west of the Sioux at Bay Mills that was recognized in the 1930s. But the Sault Ste. Marie tribe was not federally recognized until the 1970s. It was a serious effort by a group of people. But since then, we're talking roughly 50 years, the Sault Ste. Marie tribe has become a major employer and influencer in Sault Ste. Marie. They have a large hotel and casino, for example. They have health services and that sort of thing. They bought up quite a few businesses in the city of Sault Ste. Marie, which takes them off the tax roll. So that's a factor here today.
What do you think is important for people to know about the history of Sault Ste. Marie and how it fits into Michigan's story?
Well, it is so important to realize that Michigan was part of New France until 1763. And indeed, there was a major ceremonial function that occurred here in 1671 that is not well known at all, probably. It's referred to as the Pageant of Saint Lusson. And in 1671, the French King Louis XIV sent an emissary, and they even tried to prepare the way by the previous fall, inviting all kinds of tribes from the Upper Great Lakes to Sault Ste. Marie in June of 1671, where this ceremony took place, and a representative of the King of France laid claim to literally much of North America. It had words like parts known and unknown. So it was really quite an extravagant claim that they were making. But that claim was made even before the claim to Louisiana was made in 1682 by LaSalle. So the one here in Sault Ste. Marie even predates Louisiana.
Oh, to think about how our lives might have been different.
Yes, indeed. And I'm an advocate for the city to promote the French part of our heritage. Nobody can see this, but I'm going to stand up a little bit. You can see, at least. I'm wearing a T-shirt that has the French fleur-de-lis on it.
Yeah, and, this is the emblem that a lot of people associate with New Orleans.
You know, when we were in New Orleans, they have the fleur-de-lis on their garbage cans, the municipal garbage cans. I think we ought to be trying to promote that more for Sault Ste. Marie.
Bernie Arvik has been my guest. He's a board member at the Chippewa County Historical Society and author. Bernie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you, April.
The thick smoke that drifted south from Canadian wildfires earlier this summer has cleared out, but a changing climate will very likely fuel more intense and more frequent wildfires, potentially closer to home. That means that northern Michigan's wine industry could be facing a new challenge to growing grapes. It's called smoke taint. Interlochen Public Radio's climate solutions reporter Vivian Law takes us today into the vineyard.
On a rolling hill in Sutton's Bay, Andy Fless kneels near a row of leafy grapevines.
So we have some muscat. We're seeing, I don't want to get too in the weeds here, literally, figuratively, but we are entering a bushy row.
He untucks a small bunch of young green muscat grapes.
The berries we're kind of in that buckshot berry stage.
They're about as small as the ammo used in deer hunting.
It's a very American way to describe it. It's a little strange. We have to use bullets to describe fruit development, but that is what it's called because they're that size.
Fless is the vineyard manager for Shady Lane Cellars. Grapes this small mean that Fless wasn't too worried about how a few days of thick smoke might impact the crop. It's early in the growing season. But the winery's general manager and head winemaker, Casey Wiersba, says that the haze made her think about future smoky days.
I think having the smoke incidents happen at this time in the grape growing when they wouldn't be affected kind of spurred me to think, wow, I need to be prepared in case if this happens a month from now, where our fruit will definitely be impacted then.
Wiersba wants to be prepared for what the industry calls smoke taint. It's what happens when grapes are exposed to smoke for long periods of time and can lead to unwanted flavors in the finished wine. And Wiersba says the damage is only obvious after the wine has been made.
So going up to the grapes, we might be like, oh, we don't smell the smoke anymore. We don't really taste it when we're sampling the grapes. But then when it goes through fermentation process, those volatile chemicals, particles, are released, and that's when you can actually detect the smoke taint.
Those off flavors have been described as ashy, burnt, or just smoky. Next time there's heavy smoke from wildfires, Wiersba plans to send grape samples to a lab that can detect smoke compounds. That could inform whether she uses certain winemaking techniques, like adding enzymes to mask changes to flavor.
We can't really erase the impact. It's there, but we can minimize it. We can try to make it not worse.
Experts say the smoke in Michigan wasn't intense enough to impact the season's grapes. It takes a lot of smoke, over more than just a few days, and typically closer fires to produce changes in flavor. Those conditions are more common on the West Coast, where climate change has fueled more frequent and intense wildfires.
Solutions to smoke impact and smoke taint are not simple. There may not be one silver bullet that takes care of it, and likely it's going to be many things that need to come together.
Ben Montpetit heads the University of California Davis's Viticulture Department, which is home to some of the country's most extensive research on smoke taint.
As much as we can prepare, there are going to be fires in the future, and unfortunately they will impact wine regions.
That means growers in Michigan might have to adapt to this new challenge, on top of what the industry is already facing. Fless with Shady Lane Cellars says this growing season in northern Michigan has already been tough between fluctuating temperatures and extreme rainfall.
Global warming doesn't mean everywhere is going to be warmer every single year. I think what it means for us is that it's climate chaos, and it's very hard to predict what is going to happen. I mean, we didn't even hear about, oh, there's going to be this smoke coming your way in 7 days.
He says variability is just part of farming in this region. For now, with no smoke in the forecast, Fless is expecting a good vintage this season. I'm Vivian Law.
It's time for us to pause for just a minute. After the break, a Detroit story that goes from Cole Porter to Philip Marlowe.
Detroit? Oh my goodness. Was an uncombed historical wilderness.
That's next. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The new novel Fortune of Sand by Detroit-born writer Ruta Sepetys is a glittering jewel of a story set in Jazz Age Detroit. The city's booming. Edsel Ford is alive and well and looking to improve on his dad's legacy. And the fictional Lennox family, the clan behind an auto glass empire, is bubbling over with secrets. What may appear at first to be a romance or screwball comedy, Fortune of Glass actually has much bigger fish to fry. Ruta Sepetys lives in Tennessee these days, and she joins us now. Ruta, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the book. It's a real delight.
Oh, thank you. It was a delight to write and research. Trust me.
Was there a story or an image that first got you interested in this particular time and place in history as a setting for fiction?
Yes. When I was about 9 years old, my family was invited to attend an event at the home of the fashion editor of the Detroit News. And she lived in the Detroit Golf Club in one of these storied 1920s mansions. And it was then that I learned that some homes in Detroit and Grosse Pointe had hidden speakeasies and underground tunnels. And it sparked something that lived in the attic of my imagination for 50 years.
Yeah. What do you think is so, because there are a number of books that have focused on the Jazz Age. Do you think that there's something particularly appealing about the 20s for us at this moment in history?
Yes, I do. And it even inspired the title, you know, A Fortune of Sand. These themes of fortune and facade, the dominant narrative of the 1920s is one of flappers and jazz and facade, truly. When I was researching, that's not what I found. Very few people were living